Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're getting back to basics in the bush. Well, not quite basics. Alan Baxter is Australia's horror boss and he's incapable of doing anything basic. But his new novel, Blood Covenant, is certainly retro in deeply satisfying ways. Blood Covenant's the kind of horror novel that got most people my age into horror novels. It's violent, thrusting, unpretentious, and fueled by recognisably human characters who you care about. It also has some horrible villains who are still not the worst thing to befall this poor family that we meet in their isolated hotel home. Alan and I talk about the inspiration of 70s and 80s horror fiction, what exactly makes those books so compelling. We theorise why Australian horror and crime fiction overlaps so easily and well. We riff a bit on extreme horror movies, and we discuss the cosmic implications of the massive country he calls home. If you enjoy this sort of thing and want more, and want to support the show, consider becoming a patron. For a few quid a month, you can sign up, get tons of bonus episodes, join the Discord for an everlasting chat, and generally enter into a fruitful symbiotic relationship with me. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod and sign up with my thanks. But now, come with me down a back road down under. Never mind the snakes, or the spiders, or the things in the undergrowth. It's the demons and the desperados you need to beware. Let's talk scared. Hi, Alan. Welcome back to the show. And how are you, mate?
I'm very well. Thanks very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you. You're my, let's say, antipodean brother on this show. You're my go-to for all things Australian, although I have had a few Australian guests recently. Always a pleasure to have you. But I believe you're now in a more far-flung part of Australia. Have you moved to Tasmania?
Yeah. I'm moving further and further away from my roots. I can't get any further now unless I go to Antarctica, I think. I actually looked it up. I am almost as far as it's possible to be away from where I was born, because I was born in the south of England and now I'm in the south of Tasmania. So yes, we've just been here a month. So we just really are just kind of finding our feet and getting things organised.
Does Tasmania feel very different to mainland Australia? I always imagine it's kind of a sort of secluded jungle place. I know nothing about the country, obviously.
Secluded, yes. Jungle, quite the opposite. It's every state in Australia is like a different country. Like, I mean, I used to hop on the motorbike when I was growing up in England, and we could ride through, take the ferry from Dover to Calais, and then we could ride through five countries in one day, literally in one day. And here you can ride all day long and still be in the same state. So different states are like different countries, and Northern Territory is so different to New South Wales and what have you. It's an enormous continent. And Tasmania is very European. If anything, the way I describe it is, if you took Scotland and you took Cornwall, Devon, West Country, and you sort of put them together into an island the size of Ireland, that's Tasmania. It's got a really European sort of vibe and climate and that sort of Scottish geography going on.
I read a book years ago called The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes, which is a vast history of the birth of Australia, you know, as a penal colony, and then afterwards, but we should say, you know, white colonial Australia.
Absolutely, yeah.
When they wrote about Tasmania, it did seem like the entire origin was Mancunian. Everybody who was anyone in Tasmania was from Manchester or Salford, so I feel a sort of kinship with the place, despite having never been there.
Yeah, and you would recognise the vibe. Like, it is a very European vibe. I mean, it's got a climate more like Southern Europe. It's got a climate more like sort of like the south of France than England, given the latitude. But the sort of the geography and the vibe is very European. It reminds me a lot of England. There are silver birch trees and apple orchards and stuff like that here, you know.
Yeah, I'll throw one more book, story recommendation in. The best horror I've read about Tasmania is a short story by Glenn Hirschberg, and it's a story called Devil in Ellen Datlow's Screams from the Dark anthology, which is obviously about the Tasmanian devil. But it's excellent. You should check it out, Alan. It's really good.
I'm reading that anthology literally right now.
Really?
I literally just started it.
Oh, wow. Well, how's that for serendipity? Well, when you get to Glenn Hirschberg's Devil, I think you'll enjoy it having just moved where you are.
That's great.
From that story to yours.
Mm.
I mean, I asked about whether it was like jungle and secluded and all that, because in some ways that would fit your latest novel, Blood Covenant, which is all about a very secluded hotel in the off season and the terrible things that go on there. It's due for release May 24th, so just a few days after this episode goes live.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a standard drill, Alan. What can you tell us to whet listeners' appetites?
Okay. It's a novel. It is set in the Bushy Mountains west of the coast in New South Wales. It kind of referenced to the Gulpeper universe, like where the Gulp and the Fall and those books are set. It's not a Gulp story. I'm just sort of using that fictional geography, okay, which is based on the real geography of the south of New South Wales, where the coast kind of goes up into the hills and heads towards the Snowy Mountains. It's a story of a bunch of thugs from Sydney, who've driven hours down into the country to do a bank heist because they think it'll be a pushover, a little country town bank, but it all goes horribly wrong. They end up on the run in a terrible state, and they see a sign for a hotel that doesn't open for another month up in the mountains. So they think that's a great place to go and lay low. So they head there to think they're going to hide out till the heat's off, only to discover that when they arrive, the family who run the hotel have just arrived to start preparing for the forthcoming season. So instead of lying low, it's suddenly a hostage situation, but it's a very bloody hostage situation. And when blood is spilled, something in the bush notices, and it's kind of ravenous, and things get consistently worse. The sort of vibe is like, what if a violent home invasion wasn't the worst thing that happened today?
Yeah, I like that. That is good. That's a great elevator pitch.
Mm.
Strange one though, right? Because I mean, we were speaking off air before we started recording about your friend and peer Karen Warren.
Mm.
And this will be, I think, the second episode in a month after Karen's, in which we talk about the admixture of home invasion and the supernatural, or at least of something else going on in the house that is being invaded.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether there's something in the Australian water right now that's bringing that theme to life, or is there any reason for that parallel, do you think? Or is it just one of those things? Is it Armageddon and Deep Impact?
Yeah. It's a strange synchronicity going on. I'm not sure. I must say, I listened to Karen's episode, and as I mentioned to you before offline, Karen's an awesome person. She's one of my favorite people in the world. We've been good friends for a long time, but I didn't actually really know anything about her new book. I was very well aware that she'd sold the book to Viper. It was all very exciting. But I hadn't really talked to her much about the plot of it. So I learned most of it from listening to the episode with you guys. Mm-hmm. And it did make me smile at the same time to think that there is this sort of vibe of, maybe it's Australia's criminal past, I don't know. There is definitely a undercurrent of sort of mixing crime and horror that happens throughout the horror genre. You know, one of my most influential authors from the past is Clive Barker, and Barker's done a great job frequently of mixing crime and horror. And I wonder if there is some of that going on. And I think maybe there is a little bit of a zeitgeist at the moment for home invasion. It's not something I did consciously. It's not something I was really aware of, but it's something I've noticed subsequently, like with my book coming out, going, oh shit, another home invasion book. So yeah, it's maybe it started with Tremblay and the cabin at the end of the world. I don't know.
Well, we can blame him for most things, can't we, really?
Mm.
On a side note here, one of these days, Alan, I'm going to have to get you to come on here and do something where you talk me through the appeal of Clive Barker.
Oh, gladly.
Because I get a lot of grief. I get so much grief. I've read barely any Barker. I hated Weave World, and I think I may be wrong about that. I love the books of Blood, but I've read... I tried Cold Heart Canyon and got nowhere with it. And I know I'm missing a trick, and it's just finding the time and inclination when I've got so much to read. So rather than me rushing to read it, I might get you on to talk to me about why I should read it. And I think my patrons would love that. So if you're game for that at some point this year, we can do it.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. I think Cold Heart Canyon is actually one of his most underrated books. So that's an interesting point right away. But it's definitely not one of his strongest, if you know what I mean. So
yeah
happy to.
Cool. Well, let's not put the cat before the horse, because the patron's there, but this is the main show and it's your time to shine. To set my stall out early, Blood Covenant, right, is the kind of novel that I miss from when I first discovered proper horror in my teens.
Oh, wow.
Good characters, really, really propelling plot that you care about because of the characters. There's a remarkable lack of pretension in the novel. Not a lack of ambition, because you pack a lot in, right? There's crime and ghostly, cosmic, whatever, we'll get into all that. But it's all delivered in this refreshingly straightforward way. And I'm aware that to certain tin ears, the phrase lack of pretension could sound like faint criticism. Because I think there's a kind of thing where horror these days, everyone's trying to constantly reinvent a wheel that's not broken. And what I'm asking you is that a particular style choice of yours, or is it just how the words come out?
It's an interesting question, actually. I think, to be honest, probably a bit of both. I enjoy reading the great sort of rich prose that you find in a lot of horror, and especially a lot of modern horror. There are some just absolutely amazingly talented lyrical writers working in horror at the moment. You know, we're in a golden age in that respect, with all kinds of horror. And I don't think I really have it in me to do that, mainly because, I don't know, I'm trying to find the right way to put it without sort of putting myself down in a way. It's not necessarily that I can't do it. It's just that I can't do it at the expense of the story that I want to tell. There's that sort of old adage in writing that, you know, don't try to write what you think people want. Write the stories that you want to read. And like yourself, I mean, I came to horror very young in the 80s. Like the first horror novel I read that just blew my mind was James Herbert, was The Fog. And so I grew up on a diet of that sort of James Herbert, Ramsey Campbell, Clive Barker, and then discovered King and stuff like that. I think the stories that I want to read, and therefore the stories that I want to write, are those ones that are just sort of deep character and propelling story. Mm-hmm. And I guess that I tell the story at the expense of potentially being more artistic with the language. I'm not sure if that's really true or not, but I think maybe that's part of it. So it is a choice to some degree, because I could take more time, but I always find that any time when I'm redrafting, any time that I find myself, to my mind, it's like, oh, I'm disappearing up my own arsehole a bit here. I edit it back. Because that sort of powerful forward motion in a book is what really excites me. And so I think that's always what I'm trying to do.
Well, yeah, and I want to be very clear that I'm not in any way talking about the artistry of your prose, because, well, you're a fine writer, and I also don't think that artistry of prose 9 times out of 10 is what gives a horror novel wings. It's interesting that you mention James Herbert and Ramsey Campbell and Barker and King. I've mentioned my kind of like ignorance of Barker. I haven't read enough Ramsey Campbell. I've read a select few. He's possibly the writer that you remind me the most of, but I know you love King and there is some of that, but James Herbert as well. Those authors just feel like they're in your blood. You're a better writer than James Herbert, but I feel you have a similar approach to story. And it's a cliche, right, to say that, you know, they don't write them like this anymore. But sometimes it is true. And your books have this flavour of 80s and 90s horror, but with updated politics. What do you think that flavour is, if you even agree with my point? What is it to you that really kind of that comes through from that era?
I mean, honestly, I don't know. I know what you're saying, and I agree with you. That stuff is definitely in my blood. That's what I grew up with. And even in terms of, you know, I was a mad fan of fantasy as a sort of teen and through my 20s. And the fantasy I loved the most would be stuff like, you know, Michael Moorcock and the Elric books and all that stuff that had those really sort of dark edges to it, but was small. You know, they were short. They weren't the big fat fantasy epics. I read those and I enjoyed those. But the sensibility of the shorter, more sort of impactful fantasy of the 70s and 80s was something that, you know, left its mark on me as much as the sort of horror boom of that same era did. I don't know. I'm not really smart enough to put my finger on what it is that makes those things what they are. I think people have definitely drifted a little bit away from the sort of momentum of those books. And I've always been a proponent of the idea of don't save ideas. You know, if you've got ideas, fucking cram them all in, put them all in. Like, don't think, oh, I'll save that for another story. I can work that. And don't think I'm going to make the most out of this idea, because there's always more ideas. There's always more that you can do. And you know, I feel like the book, the more it feels like I need to put into the story to not overwhelm the story with so many ideas, but just to sort of use everything that's available and keep everything pushing and keep raising the odds and keep, you know, sort of testing the characters, if you like. And there's that, I don't know, momentum, I think, is probably the best word I can come up with for it. There is a certain momentum to that classic horror that to some degree is a little bit lost these days. And there is some amazing slow burn horror. There is some, I mean, you were talking about Karen Warren and that sort of deferred payoff that keeps getting deferred. And she's a master of that. And that's amazing. But that's just not the sort of story that I write, much as I love to read it. So, yeah, I think that is a large part of it, is that momentum of that era that just, I just remember being enraptured by it, and that's what I want to do.
Yeah, I just wonder if it's something to do with the confidence in story and all the things that story means, because it's quite a hard thing to pin down in itself, isn't it? Plus plot plus character equals story, but there's more to it than that. You know, the confidence that story is enough, or at least it's 90% of the way there. If you've got that nailed, then the rest is ornament and perk. Whereas it feels like sometimes with a lot of horror, as I say, everyone is trying to focus on everything but what I would like them to focus on. But I mean, I'm risking upsetting people here, because I speak to a lot of authors who do a lot of interesting things, and I enjoy the vast majority of it. But I did enjoy this book for just putting story first and foremost and making me care in a relatively short few. I mean, it's not the longest novel in the world, and as I say, you pack quite a lot in.
Yeah, I think story comes first for me. And then, I mean, the way I look at it is you can have great ideas, and that's plot, and plot is what happens. But plot and what happens is irrelevant without story, and story comes from characters, you know. So plot is what happens, and story is why we give a shit. Because why do I care what the plot is if I'm not invested in the story and thereby invested in the characters? Because that's where story lives. Everything I do is in service to story first and foremost, and nothing else. There's a lot that gets lost in an edit if it doesn't do that.
So where did this story begin for you, Alan? Because as we've said, there are numerous elements to it. How did this thing come together as an idea?
Interestingly enough, the initial vibe of it with the bank robbery gone wrong was a short story. I was commissioned to write a short story for a thing. And I thought that this bunch of sort of thugs who think they're smart criminals and absolutely fuck up a bank robbery, I thought that was probably a great place to start the story. And then it didn't work for me. It wasn't happening, and I put it aside. And I, you know, I never actually delete anything. It all just, you know, gets put aside for later. There's a whole load of stuff that gets reworked potentially in future things. And so in the back of my mind, there was constantly this thing that's like that setup of this, you know, this bank robbery gone wrong. I want to use that. How can I use that? And then there was this thing in the back of my mind where it's like I wanted to do a home invasion horror, you know, because I love those sorts of things. I really enjoy those sort of books and movies that play like that. This almost, you know, like this sort of single location story. And so at some point, as is often the case for me, novels tend to get born of several ideas that suddenly all crash into each other. And it's like, oh, wow, they work together. And so this sort of aborted short story opening of a bunch of idiots messing up a bank robbery, followed by wanting to do a home invasion, was like, well, if they go on the run and hide out, there's my home invasion. There's my, you know, that's my reason for a home invasion. But then I also had this, it's difficult to talk about without giving too much away in terms of the book, but the sort of the supernatural element was another idea that had been tumbling around in my head for ages, and I couldn't figure out how to use it until that bank robbery, home invasion came together. And it's like, oh, wait a minute, that could work if I put those together. And so these things all kind of orbited each other for a while and eventually crashed together. And interestingly, this book took me 3 attempts to write. I put it aside twice because it wasn't working. I couldn't sort of mesh those things and weave those things together the way that I wanted to. It kept not working. And it was third time lucky with this book. So I started it, put it aside, wrote something else, started it again, put it aside, wrote something else, finally started and got it on the third run.
The fact that the bank robbery stuff came first lets me off the hook a little bit, right? Because the thing I was going to ask you, and I was sort of tiptoeing around it, is that you've got a family under attack in an isolated hotel. Let's just say a kid with potential special abilities or a special relationship with said hotel. It's very hard to imagine that The Shining wasn't in the back of your mind when you were writing it. And I wondered if you added the criminal thing as a clear demarcation line, but it sounds like it's the other way around.
It is, actually, yeah. I mean, this is the nature of how tunnel vision we can get when we're working on things. Like, for example, one of my earlier books, a novel called Hidden City, somebody mentioned, they were like, oh, this is such a great sort of new take on zombies. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's not a zombie book. And then when I stopped and thought about it, I was like, oh, fuck, and it kind of is, actually. And I didn't know. I had no idea. It made sense to me afterwards. And it was a little bit like this, where a beta reader came back and went, I love the Shining vibes in this. And I was like, what do you mean, Shining vibes? And it's like, oh, wait, fucking hell, of course. Okay, yeah. And then, like, as soon as it was pointed out to me, it's like, well, yeah, that's actually true. It was, the novel was born mainly from the urge to build something around a home invasion with a supernatural bent than actually The Shining in the first place. So, yeah.
As I said to Karen, there have been supernaturally inflicted home invasions, or at least there have been things where criminals break in and they find out, oh my God, this house is a dark place. What makes this different, and I can't really think of any other example that's quite like it, is it's very much a tripartite structure, because you've got the supernatural thing, and both the criminals and the family are under threat from it, as well as from each other. So it's a real cat's cradle of cross threat, rather than what normally happens is the people break in and they work out the family they've taken, the family they've abducted are nightmarish or something. In this one, it's they're on an even keel in a certain way against this larger macro threat. So that's a really original take on it.
Well, that you put your finger there on the problem I had, that why it took 3 runs at this to make it work. Because, yeah, balancing that, weaving that together was the real sort of the trick of it. And I honestly wasn't sure if I was going to be able to pull it off, especially when the second time I was probably 50,000 words in, which is probably more, maybe a little more, you know, more than halfway through, when basically when the wheels fell off and it's like, fuck, this can't work, and I had to go and put it aside and think about it again. But the getting it right is I'm really pleased that I did, and I'm very proud of this book now, and it is that structure was a bastard to make work, but I'm glad I did in the end. I'm glad I persevered with it.
You said right at the start, Australian fiction has a history of melding horror and crime. What is it about Australian speculative fiction and gangs of wrong-uns? Because there's your novel, right? There's, as we said, The Underhistory by Karen Warren. There's Gabe Bergmoser's The Hunted, which is a phenomenal book about a weird, you know, criminal fraternity of a kind.
That's a wild one for sure.
If you want to go wild enough, you can take this all the way back to Mad Max, you know, with this outlandish gang, or even, what's the really classic Australian
Romper Stomper
movie? The Romper Stomper, yeah, of course. No, the really classic, like, cult B movie, my mind escapes me.
Oh, Waking Fright?
Yes, Waking Fright, you know, which is about kind of community and stuff like that. Is the gang, or the criminal subculture, or whatever you want to call it, is it a particular Australian fear?
Interestingly, I don't think it's necessarily a particular fear as such. I think it's more a particular identity to a degree. So Australia is a really unique sort of environment, in particularly obviously white colonial Australia, in as much as it's got very British roots that a lot of the sort of population largely want nothing to do with, because it's like, you know, fuck those people, they called us all criminals and sent us to the other end of the earth. It's got a large American influence in terms of a lot of pop culture that over the last sort of 50, 60 years in particular. And equally, it's like, we don't want any part of that, even though can't deny the influence it's had. And so there's very much this, you know, we're Australia, we're isolated, we're Australian, we're not this, we're not that. And so there's this kind of vibe that Australia is a very particular thing and it's a very Australian thing. And it can lead to incredible nationalism and really terrible racism. That we really do have an issue with racism in this country. But equally, there is that real association with the gang, with the outlaw. I mean, Ned Kelly, despite being criminal, is a hero here. You know, such is life, is, you know, Ned Kelly's famous line, like when he was, you know, shot to death. And I guarantee, you know, you travel around any Australian town or city, you will see several utes with such is life stickers in the back and stuff like that. You know, there's a large part of Australia really sort of vibes with the outlaw and that sort of we take care of our own, we are our own gang, we'll look after ourselves. And so of course that filters down within Australian culture as well, that you get a lot of tribalism in terms of you know, different kind of gang mentalities. And so I think that there is a lot of recognition of that within the sort of subculture of most of Australia in one way or another. So I think a lot of that gets explored frequently in Australian media, you know, and movies and books and everything else.
Because I wonder, and this is dark, and this is kind of off topic of your book. Maybe it's not, maybe it's inspiration. I wondered whether there's a kind of collective influence of the Snowtown murders. I'm not sure how familiar listeners are with those crimes, but I imagine they seized the Australian mind to some degree and filtered into horror, because they're such awful word to use, but iconic crimes.
Yeah, there are certain things that I think do in some ways stain a culture, you know. I mean, there's Port Arthur as well, which is not that far from where I live now, which was the site until relatively recently of the biggest massacre, you know, which is nothing to be proud of. But there, and, you know, and right back to the Ned Kellys, and, you know, if you've seen the Nick Cave film, The Proposition, talking about that kind of bushranger and that sort of stuff. I think there is definitely a recognition of that sort of thing, that it's like, in some ways, like, you know, if you've got the dodgy cousin in the family, everybody's sort of aware that dodgy cousin is around. Australia kind of has that as a national identity, that there are aspects of Australia that's a bit like the dodgy cousin, right? So, yeah.
I mean, I've mentioned the Snowtown murders. I won't go on. I would say to people, it's a phenomenal film about those crimes, but dear Christ, watch it at your peril.
Yeah, it is an incredibly confronting film. It is absolutely brilliant. I always talk about it as being like the film equivalent of Ketchum's A Girl Next Door. It's like, it's not the same sort of story exactly, but it has that same thing, that it's just going to fuck you up, but it's brilliant.
There's a whole
thing both of them are based on true stories, so
there's a whole thing about things happening to toes in that real life story as well as the movie. I mean, let's not forget it is, you know, there are real victims in this, but it's a phenomenal movie, but one of the most, as you say, confrontational things I've seen in a minute. The other really confrontational Australian film that kind of came out and then fell on deaf ears is Hounds of Love. Have you seen that?
No, I don't think I have.
Oh, right. Well, I'll get back to your book in a second, but Hounds of Love is basically about a couple who are abducting women.
Ah.
I mean, it's one that should come bedecked in all manner of sort of trigger warnings and stuff.
Right.
Listeners, do your due diligence. That was hard to pronounce. But yeah, Australian horror for me seems to be in the wake of Wolf Creek seems to have taken over from the French in this kind of confrontational extreme gonzo thing, you know. And I just wonder how much all of that filtered through to the literary culture.
There is a lot of crossover to it, I think. Mm. Yeah. I mean, Australia is a very young culture. I mean, it's like that old adage, you know, that British people think that 100 miles is a long way and Australians think 100 years is a long time. It's that kind of juxtaposition. We've kind of got this young adult cultural mindset. But it means that a lot of media does cross over, a lot of literary, movie, music, all that sort of stuff does blur together a lot. So, and Australia punches above its weight in horror, in movies and in authors and in, you know, so much amazing stuff comes out of this country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could talk Australian horror films all day. The Lovely Ones, one of my favourite horror movies of all time. I just love that film so much. Is it, hang on, no, the love, is it the Loved Ones? Not The Lovely Ones.
The Loved Ones. Right. Yeah. And Talk to Me came out quite recently, which is unashamed. There's no cultural cringe. It's unashamedly Australian, but it doesn't lean into it at all. Like if they hit a deer instead of a kangaroo in that one scene, you almost wouldn't notice it was Australian, sort of unless you're Australian to some degree. But just an outstanding horror film, you know, just brilliant.
I haven't summoned the courage to watch that yet just because I am too scared of the possession thing.
Yeah, I remember your possession situation, yes. No, that is probably good advice for you, Neil, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I will watch. I'll have one too many beers on a Friday night, put it on and regret it for a fortnight, but
yeah, such is it'll life. Be worth it.
Well, anyway, back to your book. Apologies for the excursion. We've mentioned some fairly evil people in the Snow Ten Murders and all of this. Like, your gang in Blood Covenant is slightly less evil than John Bunting, Robert Wagner. You've got James, Deanna, Paul, and Rick. And they present, in my opinion at least, different tiers of badness. And all the way I went through, I was thinking, is it important to have gradations of villainy in a story like this?
Definitely, to me. I've always been very much of that sort of mindset, very much reminding myself that, you know, it's a real problem, especially in horror, to have really interesting, well-rounded characters on one side and really two-dimensional villains on the other. We need all the people to be as well-rounded and well-developed in order to really feel that impact. But it was also important to me with this book, not only that the gang had different levels of involvement, but the reasons why, because they're not just straight up bad guys, you know. It's sort of subtly implied, but hopefully it's made clear enough in the book that they're from a bad sort of socioeconomic position and they kind of get towed along. And the real bad guy is James Glenn, is like the leader of the gang. And everybody is kind of pulled along in his wake, the other three. Well, you know, Paul is his younger brother and gets dragged along anyway. Deanna and James have obviously got history, and Rick's kind of this guy who's just up for any old shit and he's along for a laugh all the way. But there are levels of sort of involvement, and there is reason to some degree, like not excusable. It's not an excuse, but it is a reason sort of for why they are the way they are. And it becomes more apparent through the course of the story that, you know, James himself is the sort of catalyst for that particular gang, but there's also sort of some reason behind why he is and why he's gone quite so far as he has, and, you know, possibly why people do things they wish they hadn't and they get pulled along and then it's too late to do anything about it and so on.
Yeah, and that being pulled along, as you say, the socioeconomic reasons for that. And you do a very nice contextualizing work in a couple of scenes between Deanna and Lee, the mother of this captured family. So Lee tries to form a bond with Deanna, like to empathize with her, and it's a survival tactic. But I think I also, tell me if I'm wrong, detected a bit of satire in there, because there's one scene where Lee's talking to Deanna about quote, how the act of cooking is an act of love. Now, this is in the middle of a home invasion that's going very wrong. And Lee starts talking about how she says, even if you can't afford fancy ingredients, you can, quote, still prepare peanut butter on white bread and eat it with people you love. And Deanna says, your privilege is showing. And it reads like in the middle of all of this catastrophe, you're kind of skewering that well-meaning middle-class condescension that we all fall into from time to time.
Yeah, it's interesting that you pick up that scene, because there is a distinct privilege in not recognizing what drives some people to do some things. And, you know, it's like a friend of mine once said, you can have all the morals in the world, but they go out the window if you can't feed your family. Mm. There is a lot of truth in that, you know, like we protect our, you know, you want to be moral, you want to look after everyone, you want to do the right thing and take care of other people. But it's like in the airplane, you know, fit your own oxygen mask before helping others, because otherwise everything falls apart. And that goes right through every level of society, which is why we need to do our best to lift up the people who are worst off in our society, because in the long run, they're going to be in a position then to help other people and everybody, you know, rising tide, lifting all boats, all that shit. And so I sort of toyed with it a little bit, whether or not to keep those things going. But I wanted to have that little bit of juxtaposition where, you know, Lee is, she's fundamentally, she's a mother. She's got this sort of middle class privilege, and Deanna kind of hates her for that. And so you're not gonna like brush this aside with your, you know, aphorisms and whatever else. So that was fairly deliberate as a way to help layer where these people are in society and what drives people to do certain things. So
it made me think of a piece of writing advice that I once read from you. I think I read it. You may have told me. I don't know. I know that you said this. You said either to me or someone else that you think the best stories are the ones where something else is happening. Mm. And I don't know whether you mean something else is literally happening or, like, as we just said, there is a subtext. But can you elaborate on that piece of advice? Because it feels pertinent to Blood Covenant, and I think my listeners would be interested.
Yeah, definitely. That was, interestingly, that was advice given to me early on in my career, when somebody, now I hope I'm getting this right, I'm pretty sure it was Kat Sparks who originally said that to me. And Kat Sparks is another Australian writer, great writer, science fiction and sort of climate fiction more than anything else. But another great writer, particularly a great short story writer. And she said that to me, the best stories are where something else is happening. And that piece of advice is something that that's really stuck with me, and I've really drawn on and sort of expanded what that means in my mind. And it is literal. Other things need to be happening. So you could have a teenager who's dealing with some eldritch horror, but they've still got schoolwork to do. You know, they can't not go to school, because that just adds more problems to what's going on. So, you know, you have to have this fleshed out life. Other stuff is always going on. Cliche things, you get things like, you know, there's a detective trying to solve the case, but he's going through a messy divorce, all this sort of stuff. It's like the more stuff that's happening, you don't want to fill up the story with what might feel like irrelevant stuff, but you do need to sort of seat the realism of the story by having it in the real world. And in the real world, there's always something going on. No matter what you're trying to focus on, there's always something else going on. And when you build your story and your characters with situation like that, it adds authenticity to what you're trying to sell. But as you mentioned, it does also apply on a more sort of subtextual level, is that I always try to explore the theme of what I'm writing about, and I usually don't know what the theme is until I finish the first draft. There's this sort of subconscious thing that's going on, like, you know, with Devouring Dark, that was very much turned out to be a book about sort of grief and death and terminal illness and the justice and injustice of that. You know, there's themes become relevant as they go through. And so when I subsequently redraft, I do try to draw on those themes. And Blood Covenant is very much a story about family and about how families work and interact and support each other. And the gang are a family. They're a you know, a bunch of ne'er-do-well fuckwits, but they've been driven into this situation through circumstance and through socioeconomic issues. But they are very much a family. Like Paul and Glenn are actually brothers, but the others are no less family, found family.
Yeah,
the Moore family are a quite literal family running a family business, you know, and it's and the interactions of those things become important. So that subtext is what else is happening. You know, that's the story where something else is also happening. It's the ongoing state of being in a family and everything that that entails and all the way that that affects what you do now and why you do it and how you do it.
You write from both families, the criminals and the Moors. You write from the perspective of the two women, Lee, Deanna, from the POV of an old man, Clay, the grandfather of the Moore family, a young boy, Reuben, his grandson. You don't write ever through the eyes of James, like the head of the criminal gang, or Grant, who is, you know, the father of the Moors. The two men closest to your own age and station, I suppose, was that intentional?
Yeah, very much so. This story needed to be, and this was one of the things that sort of kind of got fixed in when I was reworking it the first time around, when I was figuring out what point of view I needed for certain things. And again, it's very much from sort of trying to extrapolate that vibe of family. And it's a cliche in a way. It's stereotyping, but there is very much this idea that, you know, this old fashioned idea that the man is in charge of the family, which is not true. It wasn't even true then in many ways, you know. Even in the old days when the man was in charge, all the man was really doing was suppressing everybody else's ability to have more input. Whereas in fact, you know, the best families are, you know, partnerships initially and then families working together and everybody listening to each other and whatever else. But it occurred to me that when with writing these two sort of families, I wanted both of the sort of leading men, if you like, of the two families to not have a voice in the telling of the story, but just to be for the story to be told from the people that were around them. So it was very much on the focus of the wider family and not the gang leader and not the father, like the dad who's, you know, supposed to be central to things, you know, even to the point where, you know, Clay and Reuben, like the grandfather and the grandson, you know, are always sort of ganging up on him and, you know, making jokes at his expense and stuff like that.
Clay is my favorite.
mine too.
well, right, here's my question. You may regret saying that. I have a sucker for kind of old war horses who don't know how to quit. Do you ever read David Gemmell when you were on your fantasy?
Not a lot, but yeah. I did read a bit.
I always loved when he had these, like, you know, aging warriors who came back for one more battle. I think there's something that moves me. I don't know. But here's a particularly cheeky question. Even though Clay is much older to you, that's much in capital letters, there's a section of this book that's a monologue, right, about Clay's lament of his age and mortality. And it felt so truthful and heartfelt. And I wondered whether that was you looking ahead and anticipating something there, Alan.
It's really interesting, isn't it? That scene where, that monologue of Clay's, you know, without blowing my own horn too much, I ended up really pleased with that. I think that's one of the better bits of writing I've sort of ever managed to put in a story. And there is definitely a part of that where I've sort of recognized where I am in life and sort of extrapolated from that. It was born of a drunken conversation with some friends where we'd been out and we were sort of just me and a few mates who hadn't caught up for a while. And I went up to the city when we're still living in New South Wales. I went up to Sydney and we hung out and we drank too many beers and got very serious at one point. And then we just sort of got silly again, thankfully. But there was this point where we were sort of getting serious and I went on this little personal rant. It wasn't exactly what Clay does in Blood Covenant, but it was sort of along those vibes. And one of my mates just sort of at the end of it, I just sort of sat there, I picked up my beer and I swigged it and I just had this little rant. He just looked at me and he went, "You should write that down, mate." And And it sort of stuck with me because I'm the same as you. I'm really interested by older characters, especially older characters, like you said, that you know, they don't know when to quit and whatever else. So many stories are told sort of from the point of view of young people, either, you know, sort of kids or young adults or teens or whatever. So many stories are told with this sort of vibrancy of life. There's a good place for that. And then you get sort of, you know, the grizzled sort of middle-aged kind of character is very popular, but you rarely get stories told from an elderly point of view. There's a certain ageism in fiction where you get to a point where you don't tell stories about people anymore. And when I first started putting together the family, Clay was the first family member in my mind. I knew I wanted a teenager who sort of was outside of the family when all the shit went down. So he's on this periphery trying to figure out what's going on, and, you know, trying to change what's happening. But central to it, the first character that came to my mind was Clay. I wanted this old man who was kind of, he's had a good life, he's got a good family, but he's just kind of shitty that he's getting old. He's like, you know, this just getting old is bullshit. It's not fair. And, you know, it's a privilege to grow old because a lot of people don't get the opportunity to do it, but equally it's a bastard of a thing to happen. And I've reached the age where I've seen people who I, you know and love and care about grow old, and I really wanted to explore that. And so sort of, yeah, my drunken little rant that night with my mates, and then this sort of character of Clay, I want to tell a lot of this story from the point of view of the elderly family member sort of thing. Yeah. Those things came together. So
yeah, I always love stories about older people. I just think I love stories about older people telling stories as well. That's my
exactly favorite. Exactly. Mm. There's so much experience in a life lived, and especially someone who's got the eloquence to kind of share some of that. I remember my grandfather telling stories, and you know, I would be just enraptured by it as a kid. And it was this weird situation where it's like, how are you so old but you know all this stuff? You know, you don't make the connection when you're a kid. And it's like, well, it's because you've lived for fucking decades. You've been through stuff. You've experienced stuff, and you can feed all that back. We need to spend a lot more time listening to the older people in our society. Not the bigots who can't stand change and say everybody should go back to the 50s, but the people who recognize, you know, the beauty of life. And, you know, we need to pay attention to what they've got to say.
Both of my grandfathers were in the Second World War. One was a prisoner of war for 4 years, nearly died. Nothing could kill him. The other one was, we joke that if he rocked up, if he was there, the Germans knew there was a battle coming, because he had the worst luck in the world. He seemed to be at every major battle in the entire war.
He's a jinx.
And I just wish I'd listened to their stories. I was too young, and I'd give anything now. I mean, this is just a cliche, right? But I'd give anything to sit and talk to them. And you talk about the bigots, and it's such, the trouble is that the venerable elders in our midst are now the people who came after the war and don't seem to remember in the way my grandparents did why we fought it and the things that we should try and not let happen again. Instead, you've now got a lot of people who have seemingly the wisdom of age, but none of the experience that we need right now.
Yeah, we are at a strange point.
I won't get to that. Listen, I've been a bit too political on recent episodes. Let's move on to supernatural things, because it's less depressing. I don't want to talk too much about this entity because it's for the readers to discover.
Sure.
I will just say I very much enjoy the fact that this darkness haunting the hotel is invoked by blood. And there's a lovely scene when some blood hits a fireplace and there's a howl from the surrounding forest, and it feels delightfully Evil Dead-ish.
Yeah, I do love that Evil Dead sort of vibe of things. It's the stories set in the bush, the Australian bush in particular, makes all forests like almost pale in comparison when you think about just the vastness, the potential vastness of Australian bush. It's like, what the fuck is out there? It could be anything.
Well, you leave a lot of wiggle room for what this thing is. But here's one specific question that you may or may not want to answer. There is a crater out behind the hotel. Oh, no, it's not a crater. It's a dip in the ground. And I've called it a crater. And I wondered, because I've read it too many times, if that was a impact crater and whether it implied some kind of extraterrestrial origin from way back when.
It could certainly be read that way if you chose to.
Nicely sidestepped. Okay, right. That's the way I'm going to choose to read it then. But as I say, you leave it very open.
Fair enough. Exactly. Yeah, I don't want to be too prescriptive about anything on that front, but there is.
I did
deliberately feed what I hope is enough to give people. That old saying of, you know, but with Mondegreens in music, where you think a song says a certain thing, and you've loved that song, you know, for 15 years, and then all of a sudden you read the lyrics and you're like, oh fuck, I've been saying that thing wrong all this time, and suddenly the song just doesn't mean the same anymore because what you thought was a lyric isn't the lyric. And I think there's a lot of that in story, and which is why I don't do a lot of really detailed description. I like to sort of give enough description for the reader to fill it in on for themselves in their mind's eye, trust the intelligence of the reader, sort of thing. And so sometimes I get accused of not explaining enough about things. But to me, I really like that ambiguity of giving people enough, and I know what I think it is, but let them decide what they think it is.
Okay. See, I'm just an absolute sucker for grand sort of narratives and linking mythologies and stories. So I was sitting here going, hang on, it's a dip. It could be a meteor. In the gulp, we find out that something fell to Earth years ago. And I'm making all sorts of connections here, thinking, oh, it's this and that.
I did mention at the start that it is set in the gulp, fictional geography. So yeah, that is not a ridiculous leap to make.
Well, I have my theories and everyone else can have theirs. But fair. That brief comparison there to it and Pennywise is coming to Earth got me thinking about something that I should have mentioned earlier because we're nearly finished and it's quite a rich topic of conversation, right? I often talk about how the size of America and its long pre-Columbian history offers so much scope for horror stories, you know, because it does. Mm.
Absolutely.
And I love those kind of native legends that kind of preempt what things that we now talk about. I find it fascinating. That kind of goes double for Australia because, to my understanding, the Aboriginal people are the oldest extant culture on Earth.
Mm.
Is that long history an influence in any way on the cosmic or spiritual, supernatural elements of your work, imaginatively, if nothing else?
Yes, yeah, imaginatively, definitely. Like, the combination of vast space and vast history is something endlessly fascinating to me. The Aboriginal culture has been, like you said, this extant civilization for tens of thousands of years, 40,000 years or more potentially. And equally, the majority of Aboriginal people are very much a storytelling culture. And their mythology and their stories are not mine to tell. So I don't sort of mine actual Aboriginal myths and legends in any way, despite being absolutely fascinated by them. But I do very much sort of recognize, I'm a huge fan of cosmic horror. Most of my work to some degree has some sort of cosmic elements to it, reflected, you know, almost in micro in terms of Australia being as vast as it is. Like, you know, we are motes of dust in an impossibly vast universe. You can feel like, you know, a mouse in an impossibly vast continent in Australia. So that there's kind of a mirror of that goes on. And I definitely take a lot of inspiration from that. And that, you know, that with the creation of Golpebber and that area, and, you know, other stories I've written where I've explored, you know, isolated outback towns and stuff like that. There's massive sort of inspiration for all kinds of horror built around that. This place is rich with sort of inspiration.
I would love to know, I don't know whether you can help me, I don't know whether any listeners can help me with this, whether there are any Australian Aboriginal horror writers or speculative writers. Because I've tried to do a bit of a dive online based upon the question I just asked you. And all I'm finding when I'm searching on Reddit or whatever is people naming stories by white people about Aboriginal myth, which is kind of not what I'm after.
Yeah.
So if anyone knows of any authors that I could read or stories or whatever, I've seen a few Lovecraftian anthology stories mentioned. But yeah, listeners, let me know if you know of any Aboriginal authors, because that would be very interesting. Because I know nothing really about the belief structure. I mean, I'm aware of the Dreamtime, but I don't really know anything, because it's not a culture that permeates in the way that, say, you know, Indigenous American culture has in recent years.
Well, that's it. And I think a lot of it is because a lot of Aboriginal culture is an oral culture. A lot of telling stories and keeping their stories. A lot of Aboriginal culture is based around who can tell those stories. You know, certain people can and can't tell certain stories. There are people out there doing it, though. Like there are Aboriginal writers. There's, you know, people like Amber Quay Molyneux is doing a lot of really interesting fantasy stuff. Scotty Wilson and sort of his whole team of comics writers are doing some really interesting comic series in comic books and graphic novels, where they're exploring a lot of Aboriginal history and stuff like that. So it is out there, but it's not nearly as widely sort of available or as widely explored, like you said yourself, as Native American culture is. You know, there's a lot more of it out there, and I would certainly like to see more of it. It would be amazing, because there are some genuinely talented people out there. Another one is Claire. Oh, I'm having a mental blank words because it's quite late here. But she wrote Terra Nullius and stuff like that. She's an Aboriginal woman from Western Australia who writes really great speculative fiction and can get quite dark at times. Like, you know,
is it Claire G. Coleman?
Coleman. Sorry, it came to me as you said it. Yeah, thank you, Claire Coleman. She's a great advocate for Aboriginal storytelling, and she's a great writer as well. So you know, there are people out there doing it.
Oh, good. I'm glad I asked. I will look into this more deeply. Maybe try and get a guest on the show, because, as I say, it's massively underrepresented, certainly.
Most definitely.
But that, I mean, that's the obvious point to leap into my closing questions, Alan. You know the drill by now, but can you recommend a book for my listeners?
Yeah. I was thinking about this. I want to recommend something by another friend of mine, another Canberra writer, another friend of Karen Warren. It's all very incestuous here with with Australian writers and horror in particular. But Aaron Dries, I know Karen recommended Joseph's book, J. Ashley Smith's book, on her part, and he's an outstanding writer, and like myself, British immigrant to Australia. But I wanted to recommend Aaron Dries. You can pretty much enjoy anything by Aaron Dries, but he's got a... It's a novella, I suppose. It's a short novel called Dirty Heads, which is sort of part cosmic horror, part coming of age. It's an outstanding piece of work. Aaron's absolutely someone who should be better known. He is an outstanding writer. He's an amazing guy, a really great writer. He had a collection called Cut to Care, or Cuts to Care, that came out, I think, last year, which is a brilliant collection of short stories. And I think like 2/3 of them are original stories. And A Place for Sinners is a novel that he wrote, which is just fucking bonkers, which is a great example as well. But Dirty Heads, which I think probably qualifies as a novella more than a novel, it's a short read, is brilliant. It was one of his best works in my mind.
Okay.
But there's nothing Aaron Dries has written that you wouldn't enjoy as a horror reader. So
I met Aaron last year. Very nice man. I've made a formal promise to get him on the show next year, because this year booked up way too fast. So I know he listens to this, I think, from time to time. So if you listen, Aaron, that is still a promise, and we'll make that happen. But yeah, I haven't yet read anything by him. I'm aware of House of Size. I think I've got a copy of House of Size.
Another bonkers novel, yes, yeah. Definitely worth it. There's a madcap kind of, you know, like there's no guardrails in an Aaron Dries book.
My favourite kind. Dirty Heads, I'll add that to the list of ones to read in preparation of when I speak to him.
Absolutely.
And my last question, Alan, this has changed since last time you were on the show. What was the last thing that really scared you or freaked you out?
It's interesting because I've been thinking about this because I'm sort of aware of you asking the question, and like literally half an hour before I sat down here to talk to you, my cat vomited and there were live worms writhing around in the vomit, which was that freaked me the fuck out. That was horrendous. So yeah, there's a trip to the vet tomorrow, I think, on that front. And I was like, well, it can't be something just as straight and body horror as that. But it there was when I moved here, which is like about a month ago, which this was the thing that I was going to talk about before the cat's great performance a couple of hours ago. When I moved here, my wife and kid flew down a couple of days before I did. The cats were sort of boxed up and they were sort of kept safely at the airport and they were flown down. But because we needed to bring the car down, I put the dogs in the car and I drove down, took a couple of days. So there's me and the two dogs in the car traveling along. We got on the ferry overnight in the ferry, which isn't a great sleep because, you know, they wake you up at 5 o'clock anyway, but, you know, you're lying on a bed sliding gently back and forth because the ship's on waves. And so, but dogs are kept down in the hold where the cars are, poor things in their cages. But we were all reunited and we got in the car and we drove off the ferry. And the first thing I wanted to do was give the dogs some sort of stretch and fresh air and exercise. It was still dark when they dropped us off because the ferry gets in at 5:30 in the morning. And I drove away from the ferry port and the first place I saw on the highway that was like a rest stop area, I pulled into. And it had picnic tables and chairs and that sort of stuff. And it was otherwise dark, but there was this big arc light on a, you know, like a street lamp, but a big thing that was a motion sensor. And as I drove in, it came on and parked, got the dogs out of the car and let them walk around. The dogs are stretching their legs and whatever else, and the light went out. So I went back across in that direction. It came back on, walked away again, just letting the dogs walk around. And then it went out. And then I was like, oh God. So I turned around to go and do it again. And it came on before I got to it. And for just a moment when it came on, I saw the person who'd walked into the light and turned it on, and then they just weren't there anymore. And that freaked me the fuck out. And I don't know, bear in mind, I'd been driving for 3 days and got not much sleep on a ferry and everything else. So I don't know what happened there and whether my mind filled in the blank that someone must have put that light on by walking under it and then realized that actually there wasn't anyone there, whatever else. But for whatever reason, in the dark of northern Tasmania in early morning in a roadside rest stop with just apparently just me and the dogs, something turned that light on before I got to it, and that proper freaked me out. We all got back in the car and just drove away like almost immediately after that, and I didn't stop again until I reached a town and we could have some breakfast at a cafe.
Wow, that is quite the story. I mean, obviously, yeah, I'm joining the dots and thinking, okay, so you've now been pursued by a demon, which is why your cat's throwing up worms.
It took the demon that long to catch up because I drove away. Maybe
it's a long way, mate, isn't it? It's a big country you live in, you know, as you've said.
That's
so
it.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not going to interrogate that story because it's just too nice. I'm just going to leave it there as a perfect little thing, because we could probably do all sorts of rationalizations about your tiredness and shadows and things, but no, why spoil a good story?
Yeah, exactly. I have no better explanation for it. So, yeah.
Well, from one good story to another, in a few days from listening to this, Blood Covenant will be out. And I think we've done a good job of selling it to the listeners as a piece of, you know, the kind of horror that made 95% of us fog over the genre.
Well, that's a great compliment. I'm very happy for you to describe it like that. That makes me very happy.
Oh, good. James Herb, better written. I'll say it again. It's always just a delight to speak to you, mate. It really is. And I wish you all the luck with it and with the move and with everything.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Likewise, it's always a great pleasure to chat to you.
For now, Alan. And just for now, because you'll be back.
Great.
Thank you for talking scared.
Thanks for having me.
I do so enjoy speaking with Alan. It's one of those where every conversation just feels like we're down the pub. Hopefully I am getting back on to do that Clive Barker explainer fairly soon for the Patreon. I think he's the right person to talk me into spending some time on Barker, because I get a real sense of Barker's influence in Allen's work. In particular, that balancing of gritty human incident and vast otherworldly forces. That conjunction is certainly the driving engine in Blood Covenant. But unlike Barker, who always seemed just a bit too abstract for me, and I get it, I do, I'm wrong, I'll try again. But yeah, unlike Barker, Allen combines those two strands, the cosmic and the gritty and human, in a really tangible way. Hence all my chat about his work and this book being unpretentious. And that really isn't a coded criticism. I love Allen's tone of voice as an author. Because I do feel a little as if horror sometimes tries too hard these days. This might get me in trouble, this might piss some people off, but it's like the genre gets in its own way. In film and in fiction, I read a lot of books that strain for the next high concept, or that just endlessly circle this fixed, singular, central metaphor, or stories that just orbit real-world socio-political trauma. And don't get me wrong, that's horror's job, to reflect our world through a cracked mirror, right? And I'm the guy who always chafes at the idea that horror could possibly be apolitical, because it can't. But it is nice now and then to read something that is just a well-told, gnarly story about mad stuff happening to interesting people. I could do with a little more of that. And like I said to Alan, I don't mean simple or dumb. Right? Blood Covenant isn't. Some of the best books I've read in the last year, Looking Glass Sound, The Reformatory, Malamud's Incidents Around the House, I mean, wait for that, but not a one of them could be considered trivial or simple. But they also have few pretensions. They're first and foremost great stories that try and scare you and move you before they do anything else. And it seems mad in some ways to say that about Looking Glass Sound, which is incredibly tangled and postmodern, and sounds quite pretentious if I was to describe it in synopsis form. But the story is still central in that book. It's just that Kat Ward spends all her time telling and then dismantling said story. But it's all about story, right? All I'm saying is straightforward is not a bad word. Commercial, not always a bad thing. That kind of horror can be so effective, maybe more effective, right? Then again, I've ranted on here, and yet I still put House of Leaves at the number 2 spot in my list of best horror novels of all time. So clearly, I'm a hypocrite. The point I'm making is the genre contains multitudes. I would just like a few more books like Alan Baxter's Blood Covenant. It's a good story and you'll enjoy it. So drop me an email at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter, Insta, Threads, all of them, at TalkScaredPod. Tell me your thoughts on all of this. Am I being an inverted snob, or do you agree with me? Just a little. And also, don't forget the Patreon if you want just loads of bonus stuff and my eternal gratitude for helping keep this show on the road. Patreon.com/TalkingScaredPod to sign up. And just last night, I recorded my first of what I'm calling shriek-along episodes, where I get a gaggle, a collection. How insulting, a gaggle. When I get a collection of some of the top tier Patreon members on a call with me, and we talked about horror and books and all the things we like. It was fun. I'm going to put it live for you all to listen to soon. I'm back next week with an episode that will hopefully delight a lot of you and maybe drag in some new listeners, because it'll be my first ever graphic novel on Talking Scared. And I've started big with one of the current aristocrats of the form, Emile Ferris, who's back with her the second volume in her epic, My Favourite Thing is Monsters. You won't want to miss it. It's an inspiring conversation, trust me. Until then, mow an old neighbour's lawn, drink lemonade, worship the fiery orb that has returned to the sky. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.